The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to Powerful Conversations, featuring your host and moderator, Monica Phillips. Today, we'll spotlight the thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and industry professionals to bring you inspired discussions, engaging wisdom, and of course, powerful conversations. Now, here's your host, Monica Phillips.
Welcome to this episode of Powerful Conversations. Thank you for joining us. I am delighted to be joined by two incredible guests today. Amy Pressman, who's the co-founder of Medallia. Medallia is a software as a service, customer experience management, and enterprise feedback management software, and provides services to hospitality, retail, financial services, high tech, and business to business companies in the US and internationally. Welcome, Amy.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And Ashleen Hassel is joining us. She's the head of global customer experience at Airbnb. Ashleen is responsible for Airbnb's customer experience operations globally. She leads a team focused on supporting every element of the guest and host experience on Airbnb. She also heads Airbnb's Dublin office, where she's calling in from today, and it's the largest base outside of the U.S. She is also a client of Medallia, so we'll be able to connect the dots on what that customer experience is in a global context. Welcome, Ashleen.
Thank you, and delighted to be here.
So, Amy, you started Medallia when you were working as a consultant for the Boston Consulting Group. You had this idea on creating competitive benchmark projects and how we could understand the customer's needs better to create better competition. What made you start? What was that you first wanted to start?
Oh, it was just the pain of being a frequent traveler. And understanding that the hotel in particular where I was staying didn't understand how dissatisfied I was. And on paper, and with all the tools we had as consultants at that time, I looked like a super loyal customer because I was essentially living in that hotel. But the hotel couldn't give me consistently a non-smoking room. And so I was telling everybody I knew, don't stay at that hotel. So it was, and it just felt the pain. I wanted the hotel to understand so they could deliver a better customer experience. The internet was starting to come into its own. It offered a vehicle for starting to connect companies to what their, to the voices of their customers so they could do a better job and create more customers.
What do you think of in terms of what Medallia is now and that original idea you had?
You know, so much has changed in the way customers talk to and about companies. We didn't have social media back then. We didn't have these amazing disruptive companies like Airbnb that have the voice of the customer in many ways built into their business model. But the fundamental premise is still the same, that companies that do the best are companies that stay abreast of what their customers want and what their customers need and are removing friction points at scale. They're creating new value at scale, and they're basically, they're creating customers. And so it's the same fundamental need, just different dynamics than when we started.
Mm-hmm. What does Medallia mean, the name?
It's a play, and it's maybe timely right now, but it's a play on the medals, like a silver, gold, and bronze medal. And we were really thinking about companies striving to get better, getting better at getting better. And to us, you know, things like the Olympics are, you know, great examples of people pushing to do the best possible job and always learning and getting better. So that was sort of the original idea. I will say that when we started, we were bootstrapped, very low budget. So instead of silver, gold, and bronze, we had kind of a yellow, a gray, and a baby poop brown. and so over time, we shifted to blue and, you know, to suggest blue ribbons, but it's really the idea of striving and getting better.
Yeah, and that's great. So your focus is helping customers engage with their own clients. How do you do that for Medallia?
We use our own software for sure. It is really interesting because I mentioned that we were bootstrapped in the beginning for 10 years. But when we went out for funding and we were talking to a number of investors, one of the questions many of them asked was, do you use your own software? And of course. How could you possibly run a company and not believe in your own software? And apparently a lot of software companies do not use their own software, but we do. So, I just the other day called back a detractor at one of our customers to really sit down and get feedback about how we can improve the customer experience for that person. So we're constantly using it to think about how we eliminate friction points for our customers, how we deliver new value, how we, enhance our product. Or we absolutely want to keep the finger on the pulse.
Yeah, I think you'd have to use it. And by doing that, you can identify where the pain points are for yourselves, how you want to make it better for yourselves to really create that best experience for everyone else. So before co-founding Medallia in 2001, you worked as a consultant for Boston Consulting Group. Before that, you were a legislative aide on Capitol Hill and a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras. How did those experiences contribute to what you're doing now?
In many ways. So the main takeaways, I'd say, as a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras, I was actually stationed in a town that had been the former headquarters of United Fruit. And what I learned from that is, the Honduran government had passed some laws. United Fruit was generating wealth for the town where I lived, and people who worked for it had good jobs, good health care, good education, and I realized that business can be the engine. It was a stronger engine for good than what I saw the NGOs doing. So that's when I decided I want to go into business. And then in terms of Capitol Hill, one of the things that I was engaged with, it was at a time when the U.S. was very focused on how the Japanese were doing electronics and automotive manufacturing and total quality management, Edward Deming, and I was one of the staffers that helped with hearings on these issues. And the idea about total quality management, and you can't have quality owned by a part of a company, it has to be part of the DNA of a company, is very relevant to how we think about customer experience. Customer experience is not about customer service. It cannot be owned by the customer service part of an organization. It has to be part of the DNA of the company, because everything that a company does, from the way they package products, sell them, produce them, impacts the customer experience. So there was a lot of analogousness to what happened with total quality management and customer experience. I'd love to get Ashleen's perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to bring Ashleen into the conversation now. Ashleen, Airbnb was founded in 2008. Tell me about your role and how you kind of define that global customer experience at Airbnb and what you've seen change in how you manage those relationships.
Yeah, sure. So I joined Airbnb in 2014 in February. And shortly after joining, one of the asks, because of my background in customer experience and leveraging NPS, was to take a look at how Airbnb was collecting feedback from users. And because the founders really, built the product based on customer and their community insights, and in the early days in 2008, that literally was Joe and Brian, getting on a plane, flying to New York, and going door to door to their hosts and asking them how they could do better, right? And over the years since 2008, that had, developed into different survey vehicles, different people owning insights from our hosts and guests. And when I came on board, they asked me to take a look at that and see, were there opportunities for improvement? So as part of that, we said, yes, there are opportunities for improvement. We really could get an aggregated view of what our hosts and guests are saying instead of it being in pockets throughout the company, and really have a shared, opinion about what we needed to do to get better. So that's when we were looking for a partner to help us on that journey. And we were introduced to Medallia, who I had known through some other work I had done over in Europe. And so we talked to the Medallia team about helping us evolve from, the disaggregated view of the customer experience to the aggregated view.
I'd love to jump in because thank you, Ashley. I think one of the things that's really interesting about this is, number one, I think Airbnb is a phenomenal company and, you know, a real disruptor in the hospitality space. And I love that, you know, description of Brian and team going door to door. What you notice about disruptor companies is they've built the voice of the customer into their business models. It's kind of, they came up with a new disruptive idea that met an unmet need, and they tend to be better at getting better by constantly, you know, talking to their customers. And I think the other thing is, what's really interesting is even disruptor companies that are getting a lot of survey data still need an operational system, both to get to be able to see themselves the way their customers do, when Ashleen talks about an aggregated view. But also there's, I think, a myth out there that you can get an operational system that helps you get better by simply doing a lot of surveys. Insights don't matter until you take action on them and figure out whether those actions were helpful or not. So you get, you know, you get insights on those actions, more actions. And so, you know, having a lot of surveys across a company is a little bit analogous to giving everybody Excel spreadsheets and having a reporting tree and saying, well, that's our financial reporting system. As you get to a certain scale, you really need to have a system that is operational, that allows the people who are working in insights and throughout the organization to focus on what's important, which is, you know, figuring out the actions, taking action, and, you know, to drive improvements in the customer experience.
I'm glad you said insights, Amy, because I read there's a great case study about the work you've done with PayPal and how they've used the Medallia platform and how it was that value of the insights they gained that allowed them to take action.
Mm-hmm.
Because I one of my favorite expressions is, don't ask for the information if you're not going to do anything with the feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that insights that actually makes that valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Like big data, right? It's, there's so much.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know which part of that is important?
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to find out from you, Ashleen, what has your customer experience program, what did it look like before Medallia, and what's the difference in terms of what it looks like now?
Yeah, sure. My day job at Airbnb, as I said, is to lead the customer experience group, which is the operational side of the house, so all of the servicing of our hosts and guests globally. So before we had the Medallia platform, there was we did have some survey data, to Amy's point, and it was kind of interesting, but really not in a tool or a method. It was actually lots and lots of Excel spreadsheets that people used to read and try and decipher what was the themes coming out of it. So what it's meant for the CX operation and how we've really embedded it into the core working of the team is that from an NPS perspective, we take a look at an individual level, at an aggregate level, on a team level, at a site level, and then obviously at a global CX level. And we've set ourselves a fairly ambitious targets on our Net Promoter Score. And so we use the insights from the data at an individual level for coaching opportunities. So we've got some rock stars who regularly get 100 MPS or 90 MPS. We leverage the insights from the comments that customers tell us about how they've really managed to achieve that, to use it as a coaching way and way to show the art of the possible to the rest of the team. At an aggregate level, we look also for themes. So when we look at our detractor data, we really look at what are the common pitfalls that we're causing detractors. And so we know from that, you know, having the two kind of really key criteria for success is somebody at the end of a call who can really answer your question and solve it. So knowledge and their ability to close and fix the issue are pretty key, as is our ability to be there in the moment. So we've actually taken a lot that those two driver areas and put concerted efforts in terms of how can we be there at the moment our hosts need us in an efficient way, and then how can we make sure that when our hosts and guests need us, we can solve their problem as quickly and effectively as possible. So we use it on an individual level and then at an aggregate level to really drive performance. And you know, we've had great success. I mean, even though our NPS is, you know, already very high, we've managed to get a year-on-year 5-point increase, which is pretty massive on a NPS scale. And so it's just testament to, I think, the power of having the data in a way that's consumable and that also helps us drive those insights that Amy talked about.
That's great. So you mentioned that kind of that live availability, the customer service by live video trend really started last September when Amazon launched the Mayday feature on its Kindle tablet. Uh-huh. And I think more and more companies are offering video chat as a way to connect to a real person. Uh-huh. There's kind of this constant dichotomy of nothing that replaces live in-person relationships and technology being everything. And so how do you see that developing in the customer service experience of having that live in-person, just like, you know, the founders of Airbnb going door-to-door? And how do you bring that engagement on into an online platform?
Yeah, so I actually had the same bias. And, you know, to me, the epitome of how technology sort of divides you from, you know, feeling human and connected is almost that phone tree when you call a company and you have to punch in numbers before you get to anybody. What we found is that our technology is actually very humanizing. So there are a couple reasons for that. Number one, I think that we wire the entire organization. So it's not just the front line, it's not just the C-suite, and it's not just the program owners, but it's everybody in the company. And people start to see how the job they do has actual impact on the end customer. And that is incredibly powerful for people because we all ultimately want to feel like what we do has impact. And when you start to hear the voice of the customer in your role, be it whether you're in accounting or whatever, and you see that what I do is having a positive impact and even a negative impact, but at least I have impact, it's a wonderful thing. The other thing is, you know, some of the best practices are, for example, to pick up the phone and call a customer when you either get a promoter, a big kind of shout out, or you have a detractor. And so this facilitates conversations that wouldn't otherwise happen. If you ask for people, for example, like as they're checking out from a hotel or in a particular situation, was everything to your satisfaction or do you have any feedback? People are often feel a little bit reluctant to give that feedback. If you ask them in a survey, and you get that data and then you pick up the phone and call them, it's like it's opened a door to have a conversation that may not have happened, you know, person to person. So in fact, it's turned out to be something that is very, very humanizing. And one of the things that, you know, the CEOs of companies that we work with have told us is that you help change our culture.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very powerful. I'd love it.
To chime in on that, though, I mean, I think the video is interesting, but I think, like, if you, you know, take it down to its core, it's really about creating that connection, which can be made by eye contact, right, which is what the video servicing helps. But it's also possible to make that connection in other ways. You can have a fantastic connection over the phone by really having true empathy with the person on the other end of the line. And one of the ways that we try and build that is we give all of our employees, internal and external, you know, guest coupons to use so that they can use the product in their own time and that they can really understand what it's like to use the platform, to stay in an Airbnb and go through that whole user experience. And we also encourage all of our team to be hosts as well. And some people can host in their homes in terms of, you know, opening up rooms, or leveraging some spare accommodation in their parents' houses. But others also can host experiences. So they can, you know, bring people on a tour of Dublin or, you know, other kinds of experiential ways to talk to guests in their geography. So that's how we also try and focus on, you know, it's important to focus on the employee experience and how building that empathy. And I think as long as you have that, the video is kind of a just another aspect of it, but you can definitely build that even in written communications if you've got the right sort of connection with on both sides of that conversation.
I tend to steer away from video because I don't always want someone to see me in my yoga pants or with my hair in a ponytail or whatever that might be. So right. I think it is an interesting conversation, though. So often you can hear that expression in so many different ways online. Mm-hmm. I love this visual that I'm picturing of this the online listening, right? The ears of the platform. Ashleen, Airbnb really thrives on this two-way feedback between, you know, the renters and the buyers. What do you call them? Guests and renters?
And hosts and guests.
Guests and rent. Yeah, hosts and guests. So how does that facilitate the customer experience that you are managing?
No, it's really pivotal to making sure that hosts and guests continue to get better and everybody feels building that trusted platform. I think one of the things Joe Gebbia talked about in his TED Talk, which you may have seen, is that, you know, they didn't get it right at the beginning. So initially, the review process was stepped. So, you know, you could give a guest could give a review, but then the host would see the review and then comment on the guest. And sometimes that put a little bit of fear in the guest in terms of retaliation, etc. So now we have a very balanced approach where both sides, if you like, of the, you know, the interaction get the opportunity to leave a review, and they leave the review at the same time, and then it's revealed when both have done it, right, or within a certain time period if they choose not to. So I think it's much more balanced now, and what we found is that we get much more objective feedback, right? And so what we want, the good news is the review system is completely honest in the sense, you know, this guest definitely stayed with this host, and this host definitely has a listing, and that hosted this guest. So both of it is very transparent in terms of they both shared the experience. But the other piece, which we've definitely improved on in the last year, is making sure that both parties feel comfortable giving honest and candid feedback, and we want to build that transparency into the rating system, etc. So it's fundamental to the trusted platform that we have, and we keep continually trying to refine it, but I think it's gotten to a very good place now.
That's great. I know that both of you have touched on the importance of the culture within your own organizations. I know how important culture is for you, Amy, and you really focus on hiring smart-driven people who take smart risks. All employees go through a one-week onboarding program where you give everyone a Kindle and a Fitbit so that you can grow their minds and get leaner, which I think is a great, great process. And then you ask everyone in the program to do something that has been holding them back, something that scares them. Tell me more about the culture you've created at Medallia and that focus on pushing people to go out and try something new.
Yeah, if you think about what we're doing, we are wiring information into companies that if companies embrace it, they can get better. But one of the tendencies that we have as individuals and as companies is sometimes it's hard to receive the feedback that is not positive. And feedback, to me, is really just a gift for you to become the best version of yourself. So what we want to create in the culture here is, how do you emerge becoming the best version of yourself? How do you hold the mirror up and see, I'm strong here? Here are areas where I need to improve. Here are areas I'm not even interested in. And how do I go and get better? And so one of the things is, most people walk around with something that they're afraid of, something that's holding them back. And I have my personal examples that I won't go into because I do share them in the onboarding. But if you can challenge people to go and do something, it's a power that is really, they're really afraid of, go and do something. It's a powerful small example of what could I unleash in myself if I stop worrying about being perfect and getting great feedback and allowed myself to not be great at something in order to become the best version of myself. I don't know if that's making sense. But
no, I love it.
I've had examples of people reach out to me saying this was life-changing. You know, people who have come out, as gay that they've never done before in a work environment because they felt like it was fine to be who they were in this environment, all kinds of things that have, but it's very consistent with the culture that, that our customers, perform the best have, which is they embrace feedback and they use it to get better. They're not worried about attaining a certain score. They're worried about improving. And then they do because of that, they do much better in terms of customer experience.
I think it's fascinating. Ashlyn, how about the culture at Airbnb? Can you talk about some of the things that really define your brand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, this was from the very get-go. You know, Joe, Brian, and Nate, like, building a strong culture was fundamental to the company, the type of company that they wanted to build. And so from the get-go, they focused on the employee experience. And that's actually one of the reasons that I joined the company, because I've always been preaching this in the larger companies I've worked in, that the employee experience is as important as the customer experience, and it's two sides of a coin, right? So what they put in place was a couple of key things, I think, which is what is sustaining the culture. The first one was our core values. And so the founders got together, really figured out what were the core values that they wanted to be at the heart of the way that we hire people, as well as the way that we interact with each other on a daily basis. And so the core values came out of that. There's six of them. What we do is we hire against those core values. So there's specific interviews on the culture side to say, is this person a fit and somebody that we want to be part of our internal community? And that's as important as your functional fit, frankly. So what we have is we're a very diverse workforce, but we all have this common thread, which I think comes from this shared, set of beliefs. And we don't always, obviously, line up exactly into the core values, but we have fundamentally line up to the mission of the company, and we believe in the mission of the company. So that's one big fundamental. And then in order to sustain it, I think very cleverly, they built a team that are focused on the employee experience. It's called our ground control team. You can get the air metaphor in a lot of our terminology. So the ground control is responsible for making sure that the employee culture is strong and that everyone who is here has a great experience, and they sustain that in every site around the globe. And then the last thing is that in the same way that Amy talked about looking at what your customers think of you, we ask our employees what they think on a regular basis. So we have employee surveys once a quarter where we ask the NPS question as well. And we take that feedback really, really seriously. And so every manager knows how the employees in their direct line of control, line of management, if you like, are feeling about the company, about feeling about working here, areas that we need to address. And there's very transparent action plans against what we need to improve. So I suppose we apply the same listening and acting discipline to our employees as we do to our customers.
And it's really interesting because we do all of those things as well. And you'll find those are common threads across, you know, some of the companies that are performing really well in terms of customer employee experience. So, you know, we do a cultural interview. We have our, you know, vision and mission and values. And then we do a regular employee survey and action the items. Yeah. So this sounds very similar, Ashleen.
Sometimes we take this for granted because I find that especially these leading, thriving unicorn companies here in Silicon Valley do this. That's what makes you great. That's what makes Medallia great. That's what makes Airbnb great. And there are a lot of organizations that don't have this figured out, that in fact, when you hire great people and you empower them and you create that opportunity for them, they become your fan club. Mm-hmm. They become your evangelist. They become your recruitment center and your sales force. And they create this space where it's a really great place to work because you've allowed that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to organizations out there who haven't quite figured that out yet?
There's a great case study of Paul O'Neill, who's a former Secretary of Treasury under George W., and when he was the CEO of Alcoa, and it was about essentially how he changed the culture of Alcoa, and he did it focusing on it's written up in the book, The Power of Habit. But he focused everybody. He found something that everyone could unify around, which was in this case safety. And he threw it, and it's a great write up in this book if anybody's interested. But we find that happens also with customer experience. When you can get something that you can unify the front line all the way up to the C-suite around and drive it through your organization, it is empowering. It gets people on the same page. And it's almost like you start to back into the mission and the values. So I actually am a big believer, and as I think I mentioned earlier, a lot of our CEOs that we work with say that we help change their culture. I do think getting something that everyone can rally around and building it into your organization is extremely powerful. And customer experience is a very powerful rallying cry, because all of us as employees are also customers of other companies. And we want to deliver great experiences, and we love the feedback when we start to do that. So people, as they start to impact this, really, they really get motivated.
Yeah, it's exciting. Ashleen, what are some of the insights that you've learned from working from using Medallia that have resulted in action that you've taken?
Yeah, I think I mentioned some of them earlier, but I think on an aggregate level, like we listen to from an operations level in terms of the CX team, I talked about how we've taken that and really put in actions around how we make sure that we, you know, satisfy the two drivers about being there and also being able to answer our hosts and guests questions as efficiently and effectively as possible. On a broader vein, we've done we did some great work with Medallia in terms of some workshops that we ran in across all geographies, one in Dublin, Singapore, and San Francisco. And we brought together the country, the Airbnb's country leaders, business analysts, operational leads, and we told them from a market level what the data from our surveys after a trip or after a relationship survey, which we do on a quarterly basis with our hosts and guests, are saying in those markets. And that created a lot of focus, I would say, in each geography. And every geography is actually different. You know, we have some common threads, but there were nuances in every market that those regional leaders and the people in those workshops were able to take and then action within their operating team. So it was a really good testament to taking all of that data, and we get lots of it, and really distilling it down to three or four things that we could absolutely action in each geography and make sure that we were continuing to improve the experience. So
I have a friend who wrote a blog post about his Airbnb experiences. He's actually, he and his wife sold their home, and they are global executives. They work by computer. They travel the world. They stay with friends occasionally, but mostly they rely on Airbnb all over the world. And I wonder, do you have a program that rewards your frequent clients, your best of the best, those regular clients, users?
Yeah, that wasn't Michael Campbell, is it, and his wife Debbie, who are going around. So the senior nomads are hilarious, and they came to Dublin and actually to the office here, and they've also come to our open. So I think on the host side, we've done better. One of the things that we've done really based on the feedback from our hosts is that they didn't feel, you know, rewarded for being tenured hosts and for giving great experiences. And so we have a super host program now, which acknowledges our great hosts, and there's several criteria that go into super host status, and we review that every 6 months. And so that has been a way to acknowledge in a very public way, because you see it on a host profile if they've reached like this really top echelon of giving fantastic hospitality to guests. The other thing we felt it did on the host side was we give them rewards and gifts, obviously, for significant milestones. And those can be, you know, tenure based, but can also be when they've had, you know, recognition of some key milestones of like, it's a year today since you joined the platform, and look at all the great experiences you've given. So we've done, I think, a good job of really rewarding our hosts. In terms of our frequent flyers, though, or frequent guests, that is an area of opportunity for us, I think. We have talked about, and I think we're looking at some options there, and really trying to figure out how we embrace those people who trust us with their vacations, with their business travel, and really leverage our listings substantially. So that is an area of opportunity, but I think we've made a lot of progress on the host side.
That's excellent. Yeah, his name is Tyler Suchman, and his wife.
Okay.
Do you know the name?
No, I don't know. I haven't met Tyler. No, not that I recall any.
So Amy, you started as a bootstrap company, and you were profitable within your second year with capital from Sequoia, and now Medallia's valuation is worth over $1 billion. What does that feel like to run a unicorn company?
I think it's great to start and run a company regardless of the label that people put on it. So it was great when it was tiny. It's great now. And
What was it like to see, what's that experience like for you to see that growth?
I guess I liken it to being a parent. You know, you turn around and how did this 6 foot whatever kid, like, how did that happen, right? I think most people who are parents can relate to that.
So we were talking about the teenagers earlier. Medallia in its teenager phase.
I would say so. There's a little bit of acne for sure.
That's great. What does it take as an entrepreneur to take that risk to start a company?
You know, I think that we are live in a world of just accelerating pace of change, and there's no such thing as no risk. So there's no path, even ones that seem quote unquote safe. So to me, it never felt like a risk. It felt like a passion, and it was such a good place to follow your passion. Now, there were incredibly lean days. I remember refusing to spend $15 on an electric egg beater to whip my whipped cream because we weren't paying ourselves and we were living on savings, and I didn't know where that $15 was going to come from.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time it was kind of a pain. I look back at it a little bit romantically, but it's just amazing. It's an amazing thing to follow your passion.
Yeah, for sure. What would you tell others who are just starting out as an entrepreneur who maybe don't have the opportunity to take that risk, can't fund themselves or don't have the funding yet? Or
I think there's always ways. I think, I like to say that I get motivated by no, and no means constrained resources, no means all kinds of challenges. Mm-hmm. So the initial challenge is to figure out, how do I do this thing that I want to do? Like that's the first leap. My biggest advice is there's so much you have to learn, and you have to learn it really fast, and you don't have a boss teaching you. Mm-hmm. So read a lot, talk to as many people as you can, just be a sponge for knowledge and listen to absolutely everybody, even the person on the bus, and then make your own decision.
I know you have a lot of great books that you've read. Who are some of those people who really helped you most in getting to this point?
I've had a lot of mentors over the years. Our board has been tremendously helpful. I've learned a lot. The people that I work with, including the people who report to me, I mean, they often know a whole lot more. They always know a whole lot more about the areas than I do. And so I, try and learn as much as I can from them. Really just wherever and however you can, and I read a lot of books. Yeah.
You kind of have a similar story of Airbnb, of kind of that door-to-door, going out when you first started, going out to your ideal clients and saying, here's what we're doing. We want you to try this. Tell me a little bit about what that was like when you first started.
Yeah, so because the inspiration for the company came as a result of our experiences as frequent travelers, we were targeting the hotel industry. And we actually went and pitched a free pilot to Hilton Hotels on September 10th and came back, and it was 9/11. And that was a really, obviously, horrible day on so many dimensions, but we kind of I remember wandering around the block asking, do we have a company here? Will hotels even be interested? What's the world going to be like? Because hotels were reeling from that experience. We just did it anyway. We persisted
Was there a breakthrough moment for you?
I think that was a breakthrough moment. And the reason is I always knew I had wanted to start a company. I wrote it in my application to business school. And then when we decided to start it here in Silicon Valley, it was during the bubble. Everybody was starting a company, right? Remember that? And at that moment, when things looked really bleak, it was at that moment that I sort of say, well, am I an entrepreneur or am I not? And so committing to it when we did not know how we were going to pay ourselves, whether we would get any customers, whether we would, what it would be like to run a business in a world that had dramatically changed overnight. That was a defining moment, because it was at that moment that I think we realized, yes, we are entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. From a leadership perspective, what are some of the critical challenges you've overcome?
or in the process of overcoming? It is a huge challenge to learn how to do different jobs that you've never done before, and you're not being guided by a boss who has done them. So to scale a company, which I have never done before, so that is a constant challenge about how how to go about it. That said, I have noticed that there are certain inflection points in a company's growth, and even though those inflection points are different, so it's like the 0 to 10 million, the 10 to 50, the 50 to 200, you know, 200 to a billion, even though those inflection points are different, there are certain signals of, oh, yes, we're in one of those inflection points. These are the things that you typically need to start doing when you're in this inflection point. Look at how your org structure is. Look at, you know, think about how you want to, you know, what your team needs to look like, that kind of thing. So, but that's been a real challenge is, you know, like constantly teaching yourself.
Is there a cheat sheet of four companies? Like, here are the key, you're in this bracket now. Here are the things that you need to be looking at.
There's no cheat sheet. I think it's really like absorbing knowledge anywhere and everywhere. And the thing is, you know, all that knowledge is incredibly helpful, and yet every situation is unique.
Yeah.
So you have to figure out, you take all that information, and then you're still going to have to make a unique set of decisions because your company is different from every other company that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Ashleen, what are some of the critical challenges you face in your role?
It's probably the scaling, similar to Amy, like Airbnb, you know, was founded in 2008, but it was really until about 2011 for it to get, you know, significant traction. And then from 2011 to 13 is when it started growing and became like, to Amy's point, like it became like, oh, this really might work, you know. And when I joined in early 2014, the company had just gone through this massive growth and really had realized that it had to get to that next stage of scaling. And so the biggest challenge for me over the last 2.5 years is catching up with the growth and really making sure that as the company scales, again, we're in, you know, like 191 countries and 34,000 cities. So we have to make sure that we can scale with the growth and be there where our hosts and guests need us. So that's been the main thing. And, you know, it's always with a mix of awe and trepidation that I listen to Brian's. Brian does sort of a weekly address to the team, and they're always very inspirational, but he's always, you know, pushing the bar and raising expectations and where we can go. And so in one way, as I said, it's incredibly motivating and exciting. And then with my operational hat on, I'm going, oh my gosh, I just have to redo my numbers again. So that's the challenge with being on the operational side of a high growth business, is that you've just always got to be sort of try and be a step ahead. But as I said, for the beginning when I joined, it was definitely catch up. And I think we're now getting into the stage where we've got some of the fundamentals in place, and, you know, and that goes for across the company. I think not just in my area, we're building out sort of the foundations. We're sort of putting the wheels on the bus as we hurtle down the motorway, I think. So
are there any other organizations or leaders you look to for as a model in that growth? Ashleen?
You know, I think, well, you know, I think you always look for at companies that have managed to continue to evolve their thinking on what is good. And so, you know, I think if you look at some companies out there, Netflix, who continues to stay ahead of really rapid growth as well, and has done a good job at meeting and staying on top of that in terms of customer expectations, whether that's in the product experience or in the service experience. I think, you know, you mentioned Amazon. I think some of the innovations that Amazon have done have been very interesting. And then in terms of our, you know, our business and hospitality, we always look at hospitality leaders, and we try and take the core tenets of true hospitality and that connection with users into all aspects of the business as well. So I think we try and pull from some of it in terms of a scale factor, some of it in terms of, like, you know, key tenets and how to do, how to stay connected with your customers, and then sparkle a bit of innovation in as well, and try and keep that happy blend as we scale and continue to improve.
I would say one of the cool things about running our company is that the early adopters of customer experience management software tend to be some of the most admired companies, because those are the companies that are most passionate about customer and customer experience and employee engagement. So we've learned a tremendous amount from our customers, who I consider to be almost partners and not just customers.
Right. Yeah. Is there one central authority on customer experience, like an association or anything like that?
There are a number of different groups. I wouldn't say that there is one central one, no.
Mm-hmm. Are you a member of any of those groups?
Yes. So not me personally, but people in the company, yeah.
That's great. What is next for the customer experience?
Oh, we have just we've just scratched the surface. I mean, I think that this is the way all companies will run their company in terms of their interaction with customers within the next decade, and we've just scratched the surface. So there's so much more growth in what we're doing. That said, I think how we stay operational, engage the customer, there's a lot more in terms of text analytics. Communication between companies and customers is moving more to a dialogue of words and less of the, surveys and ratings. I think a whole lot more on mobile. It's constantly evolving how we communicate with companies, how customers communicate, but the fundamental need is still there and it's huge.
I know you started in hospitality and you cover so many industries now. Mm-hmm. Is there one industry that really stands out for you as needing this that hasn't really engaged properly in that customer experience?
No, I'm not going to call it any industry. I'll leave it to the listeners to think with.
fair enough. I spend a lot of time with professional services, mm-hmm. and I'm very familiar with that space. And I think that there is a lot of room for growth, certainly mm-hmm. Across legal, financial services, mm-hmm. commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a possibility. But
we work with just about every type of company.
Yeah. Ashlyn, what are you seeing in customer experience that is most important for you right now?
I think it's definitely, talking about industries, over the last 10 years, I've come from, I worked in software, then I did a lot of consulting in insurance, and then I was in a telco, and then I was in accounting software, and now I'm in hospitality. So I think the one comment that you're asking about, is there a segment of industry that's not really woken up to the importance of customer experience? I don't think so, in all honesty. I think within each of those business areas, you've got companies who are enlightened and those who are still playing catch-up. But I think, one of the changes I've seen over the last few years is it was really the early adopters initially who took hold of this, really operationalizing customer feedback. And Net Promoter became a very good tool in order to do that because of its classification of users into promoters and detractors. And so I think you found early adopters about 10 years ago, listened to Fred Reichel's story and really caught on to that. And so there's something in that, right? I think it's not industry specific. It's definitely different companies at different stages of their evolution in that as we go along. I think the most important, the change that I'm kind of aware of is definitely the move to social. And this is where Amy and the team have stayed ahead of that. And I think, in terms of supporting feedback that comes from unsolicited channels, right? So it's one thing to go out and ask people how you're doing, but now they're quite willing to tell you how you're doing in a very vocal forum all the time. And so how do we stay ahead of that, leverage it, frankly, and ensure that that social voice is joined with the more solicited voice? And I do think expectations, particularly with our new batch of up-and-coming millennials who, are still in their early stages of, I suppose, wealth generation, but very quickly moving into being core targets for many, many companies. And I think we have a high population of millennials, and they have high expectations, and they're very brand savvy. And they also have the need for instant resolution or instant gratification. So I think the immediacy of some of the improvements you need to make and the immediacy of your acting on feedback and the immediacy of your responding is really increasing, on a very steep steep line right now of growth. And so that's kind of where we're focusing. How do we stay agile? How do we stay relevant in terms of being there for them and, responding to their needs? So they're the sort of evolution that I'm seeing.
I would just throw in that I think that's absolutely right, Ashleen, and just the volume of data. So being able to have great predictive and prescriptive analytics because we're being overwhelmed by, you know, various types of customer feedback and how to then, you know, really get the insights out of it at scale.
Yeah, it's great. We are almost out of time. I'd love to just end with a fun question about you. Tell us something that maybe our listeners don't know about you.
Well, let's see. I agreed to get married after dating someone for 10 weeks.
Wow. And now he's here with you as your co-founder.
That's right. That's gone pretty well.
That's great. Ashleen, what's something about you that our listeners don't know?
Oh, probably a lot. well, I love to sail. I married a non-sailor, but in 2011, I had this mad notion to do something on my bucket list, which was buy a seaworthy boat, sailboat, and sail around the Pacific. So I have a very understanding husband, so he said, sure. And I bought a catamaran and fitted it out in 2 months and then took 6 months to sail from Florida to the Pacific Islands, so in Tahiti.
That's
great. Really, speed round, Amy. Your favorite food?
Wine.
No, absolutely. That's the voice of a mom of teenagers, or maybe any age. Favorite movie?
Oh, I don't know. That's too hard.
Favorite book?
I have
maybe
so many
too hard
of them.
Also.
It's really, I mean, I have so many.
One you're reading right now?
I just finished reading The Anatomy of Peace by the Arbinger Institute. Okay. I am pushing it on people.
Yeah.
I'm getting the whole management team to read it. It's great.
I can't wait. Thank you. It has been such a pleasure. Thank you all for listening. This has been an incredible conversation on the customer experience with Amy Pressman, co-founder of Medallia, and Ashleen Hassel, the head of global customer experience at Airbnb. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
We're so happy that you've made Powerful Conversations a part of your busy week. Please join Monica Phillips for another lively discussion next Tuesday at 12 noon Eastern Time and 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll see you here then. Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.